Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. U.S. Highway 50 stretches 3,000 miles coast to coast from the Chesapeake Bay crabbing docks of Maryland to the western reaches of California. It winds through big cities, suburbs, mountains, and plains, and these days, through a whole lot of American discontent. Economic trouble, maybe more. Longtime TV news anchor Tom Brokaw traveled Highway 50 from one end to the other to see how Americans are holding up, how they may be re-envisioning the American dream. This hour On Point, Tom Brokaw tells us what he found. You can join the conversation. What do you see holding? What changing in this great wide country right now? What's your question for Tom Brokaw on the road? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Tom Brokaw, veteran TV journalist and now special correspondent for NBC News. He was anchor and managing editor for NBC Nightly News for 21 years. From 1983 to 2004, he's author of several best-selling books, including The Greatest Generation, his chronicle of the World War II generation. His new documentary, premiering next Monday on NBC's USA Network, is American Character Along Highway 50. Here he is, getting it started.
It's been called the backbone of America. One highway that cuts through the heart of a changing nation. And at every crossroad, a new story. U.S. Highway 50 heading west from the eastern shore of Maryland. We're going to take this road all the way to California in search of the American character.
Tom Brokaw joins us now from California, from Los Angeles. Tom, it's great to have you back. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Tom. It's good to be here.
What did you set out to do, sir?
Well, I set out to, as I have believed for a long time, that the story of this country is not so much within the Beltway or on Wall Street as it is out there on Main Street America, in the rural byways of this country, in the middle-sized and larger cities beyond the Potomac and beyond the Hudson River. And I've always been interested in how the American people respond to a crisis in their time. When I was White House correspondent during Watergate, I would force myself to leave the gates of the White House from time to time to go out and find out what people were thinking about that scandal. And I thought this was the perfect year to be out in America listening once again to the voices and the wisdom of the people out there.
We're going to listen into some of those voices, and we want to hear your observations and conclusions in the course of this hour. But let's get a little right here. Here's from Cambridge, Maryland, very early on in your transcontinental journey. You checked in with Amanda Bramble. She'd opened a new seafood restaurant in the middle of recession. You asked her if she saw her community losing hope in hard times.
If you still have a home to come home to, and if you still have the neighbors across the street that you can sit on the front porch with, things aren't so bad.
I think that sometimes we need a reality check. This may be America's reality check. So I think that we definitely will make it through this. I have the utmost hope.
Tom Brokaw, there it is, kind of the balance you find, and I heard it again and again. This is a reality check, America's reality check. That's a big one. Hope's still there, but at the same time, people really looking and thinking, what is going on right now?
Well, there is that wisdom in the American people about knowing when things have gone too far. There was very little finger pointing, some at the banks, obviously, but by and large, most folks understood that we had created our own bubble. And when it burst, everyone got caught in it. And the only way to work our way back to some sense of economic hope again is to put one foot in front of the other and begin to do the right things again. So many people said to me, I've spent a lot less time shopping now or figuring out how to spend my money. I spend a lot more time with my family and a lot more time trying to figure out how I can save money. That's a pretty good formula.
Things have gotten awfully simple out there. Early on in the spring, you were in Hillsboro, Ohio. You sat down with April and Dan Looper. Four children. Job's a real problem. One of the kids has cerebral palsy. Money really tight. And you asked them what they do for entertainment. It's getting pretty simple out there. Let's listen.
What do you do for entertainment for the two of you?
Entertainment is taking the kids outside and watching them run.
Or giving them markers and watching them color on each other. It's a long way from Broadway, Tom, putting the kids outside
and watching them run.
And
there is a lot of pain across the country, and the Loopers reflected that. But again, they were an example of a couple that were trying to figure out how they could survive and move forward with their four children. Dan need to keep a job because they have a daughter with cerebral palsy who needs a lot of medical attention. But he was also perusing the internet every day, trying to develop new skills as an EMT by volunteering at the local fire department. His plant was shut down in Ohio, but he got another job with the same company in Kentucky. But now it's a 1.5 hour commute in the morning and 1.5 hour at the end of the day. They also told me, and a number of families did as well, they said, you'd be surprised how many movies you can rent for $1 a night. We're renting those movies and playing them at home.
Talk to us about the path you took. U.S. 50, some people will know it very well among our listeners. Others may not. A dozen states, and it's more or less right across the middle of the country.
Well, I've looked at a lot of different highways over the years to try to do this kind of work. This one is the most, I think, representative because it does go all the way from the East Coast to the West Coast, or as they see it on the West, from the West to the East.
Right.
And it touches so many political, cultural, economic constituencies. It's a combination of red state, blue state. It's Virginia and West Virginia, as well as Ohio and Indiana and Missouri, Kansas. It dips down into Colorado, so you get the Rocky Mountain West. Then it goes across Utah and into the barren wastes of northern Nevada, and it winds up in the Golden State of California. So it's a useful journalistic artery, if you will, of this country. And you can get a very good sense of what is going on out there if you just go out and listen to the folks and watch what they're doing.
Talk about
and they are doing things. That's the other part of it, is they're taking their own lives into their own hands and saying, look, I've got to find a way out of this.
Yep. Talk about a cross-section. You've got it with U.S. 50. We're going to look at what you found them doing. We've got a lot of listeners out across that great expanse eager to talk with you, Tom Brokaw. Let's take a call right here from Pocatello, Idaho, and Haya, truck driver on the road, I think. Hi, Haya. You're on the air.
Hi. Am I speaking to Tom Brokaw?
Yes, you are, sir.
Oh, my God. Well, yeah, I've listened to you for years, and my hair is standing on end, but what a pleasure and what an honor.
Well, that's very nice.
Well, I'm off the Little Eagle Standing Rock Reservation in South Dakota. And my dad was a truck driver. I'm in a truck right now. I've been driving for 25 years. And I've seen industry disappear across this country like a bad fog in the morning. And, you know, I was wondering if what feedback you're getting from people across this country, you know, with industry going overseas and then sending back cheaper bought goods at a higher rate here, you know, people, you know, it came back to bite them in the rear end, and people now can't afford those goods anyway because they don't have the jobs that they had that went there before they started coming back, if you know what I'm saying.
And I do, and that's the biggest single issue on the minds of the American people, I think. First of all, how do we create jobs in the middle of this economic downturn, and then how do we return this country to a manufacturing and industrial base that the rest of the country, the rest of the world will want to buy our goods that are made here, as well as the people who are here. It's very tough competing with wages in Southeast Asia and in China and other places and their ability to manufacture on a scale that they do. On the other hand, a lot of companies in this country, in my judgment, gave up on the idea of innovation. I heard about a wonderful new little company the other day. It's making bamboo bicycles, and they're very sturdy, and you assemble them at home. Now, that could be the beginning of a new kind of bicycle company.
Hard to compete with China on bamboo bicycles,
Tom. We buy the bamboo from them and make the bicycles and send them back to them. You know, there will be lots of opportunities in the energy field, for example, not just in new automobiles, but new energy saving devices, that kind of thing. We'll begin to see more and more of that. But it's a highly technological world that we're moving into, and the United States still has a very high education level, and we've got to find a way that we can compete without just saying, we're just going to collect the money and send everything else overseas.
But how did you end up feeling about that at the end of this trip? Well, I saw you go through some pretty tough industrial wastelands. Did you feel in your gut? Did you find Americans feeling in their gut that there was an economic slash industrial way out of this? Can people see it, not just in Silicon Valley, but more broadly?
I think that, as I said just a moment ago, that it is the issue that troubles them most of all. Most little cities, for example, small, middle-sized cities, are trying to find a way to attract manufacturing high-end machine kind of work, for example. There is a workforce in my part of the world, the Great Plains, that is eager to have a place where they can assemble the kind of high-tech new energy components that are going to be required for everything from appliances to vehicles. But it is the issue that that most people are most concerned about. For so long in this country, we owned the manufacturing components of the world, as it were. They went from here to China to Southeast Asia. Japan seemed to be our biggest competitor, but now there is a new reality, and it's India, it's China, it's also Southeast Asia.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with longtime television news anchor Tom Brokaw about the state of the nation. He's just gone coast to coast for a news special on how Americans are faring in recession. It's American Character along Highway 50. It airs next Monday night on the USA Network. He joins us today from Los Angeles, and you're welcome to join us as well. What's your report for Tom Brokaw on life right now in the USA, and what do you see when you travel the country? Are we figuring out our next big chapter? How's our resilience doing? Tom Brokaw stopped early on in Washington, D.C., talked with Michelle Reed, Chancellor of Schools there in the District of Columbia. She's brought big changes to the system in the district. Here she is explaining why.
We say you can live the American dream. If you work hard and you do the right thing, you can be anything in life. And that's not the reality for most of the kids in D.C. public school today, but that has to become the reality. And I think it's absolutely possible to do that.
American dream, not the reality. In East St. Louis, Tom Brokaw talked with Pastor Kendall Granger, the New Life Community Church, preaching a personal responsibility message to men there in the middle of crime and poverty in that city.
That's what it's going to take to get East St. Louis back. Not stimulus, not gambling boats, not just jobs, but men and families coming together.
Tom Brokaw joins us from Los Angeles. The American dream, Tom. Michelle Reed told you straight up, you know, it's supposed to be within reach for everybody who works hard, does the right thing. You can be anything in life, and she says is not happening right now. How do you see the American dream being understood, being realized or not in your travels?
Well, I think that the American dream is always there. We are still an immigrant nation, people coming to these shores every day in pursuit of the American dream, even those coming from Islamic countries, for example, where they hear so much about what is wicked about America. And when I go to those countries, they'll take me aside and say, you know, the United States is our enemy. You're too close with Israel. And then in a quieter voice, they'll say, can you help me get my daughter into Harvard or into Boston College? Or do you know how I can get a job in America? So we remain the great destination in the world. The American dream now is undergoing a reevaluation, I suppose, is the best way of describing it. A big component of the American dream is owning a home. That's not always realistic for everyone. And then if you can own a home, how large does the home have to be and how much debt do you have to assume? But most of all, I've always believed that the American dream is that we all pull together and that we keep this country moving forward and that we don't overlook any part of our population. That's what Michelle was talking about. She's one of my real heroines in this series because her parents emigrated here from Korea 40 years ago. She is a bright young woman, obviously, taught in the second grade, got involved in Teach for America, was plucked out of that to run the D.C. school system. And she's taking on a broken system and trying to fix it again. And as she says, we need 50 different strategies because as we go forward in this more competitive world, we need everybody on deck pulling on the oars. And we can't say, well, there are just parts of our zip code that are not going to get there, or there are ethnic groups that just can't compete. That's simply not the case. And she's determined to correct that.
Tom, we got a full house of people ready to talk to you, some right off of Route 50, Highway 50. Chris in Baltimore, you're on the air with Tom Brokaw. Chris.
Hello, Mr. Brokaw. It's really an honor to say hello to you and talk to you. I just wanted to preface a question of what was your initial impressions of Maryland's Eastern Shore with my own observations of growing up there. Grew up in the 60s and 70s, and back at that time, you know, possibilities of making a living on the water or farming, you know, having some livestock and chickens, that was stuff that people did. Now that is basically been eliminated. You can't make a living, a decent living on the water anymore on the Chesapeake Bay. And I had a great uncle who was old back then, and his observation back then was, we better take care of this, or when you have children, it won't be there anymore. And I just want to hear about your impressions about the Eastern Shore of Maryland. Thank you.
It's really one of my very favorite places in America. The Chesapeake Bay is, I believe, one of the natural wonders of this country and too often underappreciated. As you know, it's undergoing enormous ecological pressures because of the development around the shores of the Chesapeake Bay, second homes, and other population pressures. Mm. The watermen, as they're called, in fact, Amanda Bramble, who we heard from, calls them our crab boys. They're like cowboys, as she says. And, you know, they catch a smaller every year. They're competing against the crabmen in Southeast Asia and in other places. And then the other piece of it is that once the crab are harvested, those companies that process the crabs can't find workers to pick them because too many Americans don't want to do that kind of tedious work at those wages. And so we had a couple of people who owned a crab processing plant, and they were working very hard to get temporary workers who come in from Mexico under a special visa program that has worked successfully for them in the past. But given the political pressures about migration now, they were not able to get a full complement of workers until very late in the season. So I think that the Eastern Shore of Maryland is in many ways a complex composite of all the problems that we have. Cambridge, Maryland, on the Eastern Shore, a charming town with lots of attractions, one of the best duck decoy stores I have ever seen anywhere, has more than 13% unemployment at the beginning of the year. The second home market really had collapsed with all the mortgage problems that people had. So they're struggling to find a way back. But it has so many charms and so many attractions, I'm confident that they'll get there.
You talked with Jack Brooks, one of the crabbers there. You know, it sounded like he was pretty hard up against it. And I wonder, Chris describes, you know, scenes from the 60s and 70s when people could make a living but also kind of live in nature without overwhelming it. And that felt like an American dream. Is that still out there?
You know, it's harder now because the price of housing got so completely out of whack, for one thing. Consumer prices really did ratchet up a lot in the last 10 years. You have people who make very good incomes. And if you're on the Eastern Shore of Maryland and looking at the second home developments or the condominiums, for example, it was not unusual to see a second home that would go for $675,000 to up to $1 million. And folks who were getting a good but ordinary wage didn't feel that they can compete. Now there are some new opportunities and all that because a lot of those kinds of dwellings are vacant, obviously, and people are finding new ways to get back into them. But we lost a sense of proportion, I think. And as a friend of mine, Yvon Chouinard, who owns a company called Patagonia, he's a great outdoorsman, and he lives a kind of a Buddhist life, light on the ground, as he describes it. He said, we really have to have a new mantra in America. We have to wake up in the morning and say, what do I need? Not just what do I want? And I think a lot of families, consciously or unconsciously, are adopting that philosophy.
We heard that from any number on your travels across the country. You talked with Shannon Oliver in Fernley, Nevada, just barely with her husband holding onto their home there in the midst of the foreclosure crisis. And here's a little tape, Tom, where she's talking about trying to negotiate a new plan for her payments, but also you need a place to live, but she's kind of reaching for a new outlook as well.
I truly think we're going back to the basics of what's important in America. Material things don't matter, but a home does. A home embodies values and morals and character. It embodies everything.
Shannon Oliver in Fernley, Nevada, talking with Tom Brokaw. Let's get a call from Earhart, South Carolina. Beth, you're on the air with Tom.
Yes, hi, Tom. Thank you. Hi, Mr. Brokaw. This is an honor.
Well, thank you very much.
I know about the big story that in the Great Depression about the highway that so many folks took from the East Coast to California, hoping to find jobs and a better way of life.
And surely out of Oklahoma in those days, in the Dust Bowl in California,
Wondering if this were kind of a duplication of that travel. And also I wanted to just say, sir, that I appreciate, you know, the seriousness of our situation in this country, but I also appreciate your positive spin on things at times when it's so easy sometimes to just recall the desperation and despair. Thank
Amen.
You, sir.
Well, that's very nice to hear. I don't see a lot of migration. In fact, California has an issue that they're worried about out-migration because of their own economic difficulties now. California has very high unemployment, as you know. It has a huge budget deficit. It still is the golden state and a destination for a lot of folks. But they're competing now with neighboring states like Utah and Arizona and even Nevada because they have a different tax structure there. So I didn't find a lot of people going up and down the highways looking for new places to live. What we found most of all is that folks were trying to solve these problems where they are. We were in Emporia, Kansas, for example, which is the home of the Emporia Gazette. William Allen White, one of the legendary newspaper editors of our time or of American history. His great-grandson is now running the paper, and they've turned the paper from having an international view to having a more local view because he said they can – our residents have so many opportunities to find out what's going on the world on NPR. How's that for a plug, Tom?
We'll take it.
Or on MSNBC or CNN or Fox News or BBC or all the newspapers. He said we're spending our time on local news, which – there's still a big appetite for that. So I think folks are willing to be rooted where they are and try to find a way out of their situation.
You know, Beth raises history here, and you have been watching this country for such a long time from way back at KMTV, was it, in Omaha back at the beginning?
Yes. I'm a child of it. I'm a child of the Depression. My parents went through the worst of it. And I grew up with those stories and with that sensibility, I suppose, that it could come again any day. And you have to be very careful.
You've talked with us about what you found more or less timeless on the road. But I wonder what you found different this time, maybe fundamentally different in what people are facing or the way they're facing it.
The line that everyone used, and if I can have an application, it would be it's time for America to reset, as it were, to reboot in a computer age term. Mm. I think that they felt that we have to examine who we are, how we got to where we are, and where we want to get to. We ought to have some goals in mind and have more of a dialogue about what are the real values of this country. Everywhere I go, at the high end of America, low and in the middle, there is a consensus, if you will, that everything got wildly out of whack. There was too much debt. There was too much celebration of wealth for the sake of it. You know, even Warren Buffett, who's the second richest man in the world, is the first one to say that mm-hmm. we kind of lost our way. And that it doesn't mean we go back to wearing sackcloth and ashes. We can have very, very good lives, but also have authentic proportion within those lives. And if I were to say there was a common theme across the country, it is that. Let's pay attention to the fundamentals, like Michelle Rhee and getting education in shape, restoring our industrial and manufacturing base, and that means we're going to have to work harder at coming up with innovation and developing the products that the country needs, and finding a way to get, if you will, a dialogue across all these ideological lines that exist in the country instead of having these food fight frenzies that we're going through.
Well, what about that? Out of the Great Depression came some pretty big political sea changes in this country, which had a lot of ramifications in terms of policy Do you feel the energy for those coming? I mean, in a way, we saw it already with the election, I suppose, of Barack Obama. But do you see a wave still rolling on the political front, Tom?
Well, I don't. What I often say is that these problems are not shake and bake. They don't get solved overnight. And they didn't begin on January 20th when Barack Obama was sworn in. And everyone had a role, and the Democrats and Republicans alike. If you go back to the Great Depression, we did have seismic changes in our social and economic structure. But there was a lot of opposition to it at the time as well. Father Coughlin on the radio, for example, there were the isolationists.
Glenn Beck of his day, maybe.
Right, Glenn Beck of his day. And there were the people who didn't want us to get involved in World War II, the isolationists, and they had a great deal to say. FDR was challenged constantly. In fact, when he died in some petroleum clubs in the Southwest, there were parties that celebrated his death. So it's never been a rose garden in this country, but democracies ought not to be. I like vigorous and robust debate, but I also would like to see more of. Let's see if we can't find some common ground in that debate, or try to settle on what we think is the destination that serves the common welfare of this country.
Let's get a call from West Hartford, Connecticut. David, you're on the air with Tom Brokaw.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to speak with you both. A quick question, Mr. Brokaw. I think you're in a unique position to compare and contrast the very, very difficult times we had, say, in between the Tet Offensive and the Watergate era, and the terrible times we're experiencing now, vis-a-vis economy, war, etc. You wrote the book on the 60s, so I don't have to tell you.
Boom, Voices of the 60s came out a couple of years ago. That was a pretty rough time. Do you find parallels, Tom Brokaw, or not?
I do, and I often use that as an example of people say, well, my God, this is just an awful decade that we've just gotten through. I say, let me take you back to the 60s. It began with the hope of John F. Kennedy as the elected president of the United States. Very early in his first year in office, we had the Bay of Pigs, the Berlin Wall going up. He was savaged by Nikita Khrushchev, who was then running the Soviet Union in their first meeting. We had the Cuban Missile Crisis. Then he was assassinated in 1963. It gave rise to the 60s and all the turmoil of that time. In 68 alone, we lost more than 15,000 people in Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson left the presidency. Bobby Kennedy and Dr. King were both assassinated. We had the riots in the streets of Chicago. But at the end of the year, we rendezvoused with the moon, and we began to work our way out of it. Richard Nixon was elected. He promised to pull the country back together again and, of course, gave us Watergate. So we have survived a lot. Let me just, if I can, I'll share a personal story with
Please.
You. As I said, I grew up with the memories of the Depression. I was born in 1940, and my parents came through the worst of it in northern South Dakota. My mother's family lost her farm, and my dad had to race all over the Midwest to find any kind of work that he could. And I remember how difficult it was just based on the stories that they told. My mother now lives in California. She's 93 years of age, and she has an entirely different life than she ever expected to have. And during shortly before Thanksgiving, we were together with the whole family, and we went to a very upscale Mexican-American restaurant in Orange County, and it was filled to the rafters, and it was not inexpensive. The parking lot was filled with Lexuses and Mercedes and high-end cars. And I turned to my mother and I said, this is what it was like during the Great Depression, right? And she laughed. And we have to keep some perspective in mind. This is a difficult time. We need to work our way out of it. We need to be honest with each other about what caused it. But we can prevail.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with longtime television news anchor Tom Brokaw about the state of the nation. He's just been coast to coast on U.S. Highway 50 for a news special. Airs on the USA Network next Monday night, looking at Americans and how they're faring. Tom Brokaw joins us from Los Angeles, and let's get a call right here from Lebanon, Tennessee. Hayward, you're on the air with Tom Brokaw.
Yes, how are you doing today?
Pretty well.
I am retired from a truck stop. My child and my son-in-law both run it now. But several years ago, we started something called the Baloney Factor. in that we watched meat sales, breads, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. As they went up, as fuel went up, restaurant sales dropped off. And what we found is that as these fuel prices change, it's hurting these drivers who are down to pennies, and they're right. buying bread and milk and making their lunch and their dinner and their breakfast in their cab.
Yeah.
Are you seeing the same thing as you go across the country?
I am, actually. One of the people that we talked to in Ohio, her husband was in danger of losing his job, and she said, I used to mock the people, the older folks who walked through the supermarkets with their shopping carts and their coupons in hand. She said, no one collects more coupons these days than I do. So that's one more demonstration of it. But I love that formulation that you have, the baloney factor. I think that's a demonstration of the necessity of having to change ways so that they can survive. And the problem in America with the economy as closely integrated as it is that it has a domino effect. It's good for the truck driver who can buy the bread and milk and make the bologna sandwich. It's not good for those of you who are running the truck stop. So then you have to find new ways of dealing with that. We had car dealers, for example, in outside of Sacramento near Fresno, California. The number one Chrysler dealer in the state of California, 6 years running, selling a lot of big trucks. And he saw it coming early on, and he had to make the painful decision of cutting his staff by about a half, about 50%, so that he could survive. And I think he's going to be okay. But that was good news for him that he survived. But it was bad news for the employees that he had to let go. So for every action, there is a reaction in the economy. And yours is about as a practical a demonstration of that as I've yet come across. So we have to work our way out of it.
Truck stop, parking lots, definitely not Lexus dealerships there. You know, Tom, as I watched you on the road, it's interesting because you're such an icon in the media, have been for such a long time. You've written about hard times and good times. But really, in a way, all the times you wrote about were mainly out of the American century, the time of American preeminence. And I almost saw in your documentary people reaching out to you as a kind of reassurance, kind of an icon or token, and I mean that with respect, of that time. But you know, in a way, it's a century that's truly in our rearview mirror.
Well, I'm not sure that they reached out to me as a beacon of hope. I think what they did feel, and I was flattered by this, is that I understood what they were going through because I've written about it so much. And I still keep my roots in many ways in the American West. I have a ranch in Montana, as you probably know. And my friends in my hometown of Yankton, South Dakota, even though I've been gone 46 years, think I'm going to move back any day now. And if I do something slightly out of line with their values, they're the first ones to let me know about it, which is very helpful to me, frankly, as a reporter. I like to say that I can walk into almost any small town in America and within 30 minutes tell you where the Republicans are having coffee and where the Democrats are having coffee, how the high school team is doing and what the big issue of the day is, because I know the physiology of these places and the DNA doesn't change over the years. I don't think the people that I encountered have given up, not just on the American dream, but on the importance of keeping America preeminent. We are competing in a different environment. I have a friend, for example, who is a young farmer. He grew up quite poor in the middle of South Dakota, but he had a real feel for agricultural sciences and good farm production. He now farms more than 30,000 acres. He can tell you to a decimal point what the price of wheat is in China, in Brazil, what the competition is in Brazil, because he keeps track of that on the internet and he deals with a broker in Omaha. So there is this adaptation that is going on.
Adaptation, but Tom, let me deal with some of the tough stuff here for a second.
Okay.
I mean, because not everybody's in that upscale Mexican-American restaurant or driving a Lexus or with a ranch in Montana or 30,000 acres. And I've got a lot of that coming in as well here. Let me respect. Here's Peter. This is on the web. On the web, things get hot. But he says, Tom Brokaw sounds like every feel-good politician and pseudo-economist spouting about how we just need to innovate more to return to the American dream. And then he goes and Peter says, we've lost the consumer electronics manufacturing industry, the telecoms equipment manufacturing industry, the machine tool industry, much of the auto industry, and Tom sees us making bamboo bicycles. It's kind of like, give me a break, Mr. Brokaw.
Well, I completely understand that. But does anyone believe, for example, that the Ford Motor Company will not be a better company because of what it's gone through in the last couple of years? There's new hope. That's a demonstration of a company that has learned the painful lesson of what they need to do to compete in the global market. I honestly think that General Motors and Chrysler will be a better company. But everybody was involved in that. The white-collar workers at General Motors, they had far too many of them. They had far too many perks. The union had gotten used to having a 400-page contract with a lot of pension and penalties built in for people who didn't show up for work. So I think that we've been through a very painful time. It doesn't mean that we can't go back and reinvent these fundamental industries that are going to be important to us, because there is no country in the world that has the capacity that we do still in our industrial economy or the kind of workforce that we do. But we have to give up on the idea that we're just going to automatically ship the jobs out. I'll take 10 seconds to tell you a story about Ohio. A couple of years ago, I judged a journalistic competition, the Livingston Awards, for young journalists, 35 and under. And two of the winners that year had gone around Ohio as bicyclists and with members of the Federal Reserve, young staffers. And they couldn't figure out why Ohio wasn't doing very well. They looked at the Schwinn Bicycle Factory, for example. And what they learned about Schwinn was they just gave up. They sent bicycle manufacturing overseas, and they didn't try to compete by coming up with new kinds of bicycles and new marketing techniques and doing the job in Ohio. And I think there's been a lot of that at the top. We all know about what's going on with the difference between workers who work at the bottom and the workers who work at the top. And when I mentioned the upscale Mexican restaurant, that was obviously a demonstration of, here is California in meltdown, Orange County with more foreclosures probably than any state outside of Nevada, and yet all the lines, for example, at the hand car wash companies in Southern California on weekends have cars around the block. People are not washing their own cars. They're still willing to pay the money. So
is that income inequality? Is that because a lot of people have, or a bunch of people have got a lot and a bunch have nothing? Or is it,
no, I think a lot of people
forgot how to wash their own cars with the hose in the driveway.
I think that's the problem. A lot of people still don't want to do that, and they're looking for a way out of it. And what I'm saying is that, and you know, the caller who said, I'm not trying to be a feel-good politician, but what I am saying is that I'm finding across the country a willingness on the part of a lot of citizens to say, look, I've learned a painful lesson here. I've got to get back to square one and reorganize my own life, and I would expect that of my employer as well. And you're finding that with employers, small manufacturers who are cutting back and learning to do more with less, for example, looking for new markets, looking for new products. We're an inventive country, and we're not going to get out of it by just saying, well, we've given up, and we're just a feel-good place.
Chris in Nashville, you're on the air with Tom Brokaw.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah.
Brooke, I greatly appreciate the work you've done. As an immigrant son, who my father grew up during the Depression, fought in World War II, I have a keen sense of what we're dealing with here. What I was calling about is I'm curious your impression of when are we going to see a balance of the suffering across the workforce. As a airline pilot for a legacy carrier, we've taken, you know, 50-60% pay cuts, lost our pensions, yet our CEOs are still granting themselves 40% bonuses, raises.
Yeah, I know.
When is this equality, you know, we should all be suffering. We all need to buck up and work at it. But why do we still see this disparity? Why do the boards of directors still allow the egregious benefits being bestowed on these CEOs?
Because the boards of directors have been appointed by those CEOs. They're very often country club pals or people who get their own perks as members of the board, either on annual fees or airplane trips to exotic resorts, and they're not very independent. There's been a fair amount of dialogue about that recently, and as you know, there's a new inquiry in the Financial Commission about what went wrong, and they've got Jamie Dimon from Chase Manhattan, J.P. Morgan Chase Manhattan going to Washington, Lloyd Blankfein from Goldman Sachs, John Mack from Morgan Stanley next week, and the new Mr. Moynihan, the new head of Bank of America, going down to answer questions. And already you're seeing the most extreme example is Goldman Sachs. They're cutting back on their bonuses and awarding stock instead of cash. But this is true across the country. I mentioned this just a moment ago, the disparity between what they earn at the top and what people who are either airline pilots or assembly line workers are earning has gotten completely out of whack. And
is that disparity an impediment to the country coming back?
I think it is. I think it's a psychological impairment. But I do think that it'll be a lot different 2 years from now. I really do. I think that there will be more independent boards. There's going to be new financial regulations that will come out of Washington in the next year that both parties are going to get together on. And they know that there is real populist anger about this. And so that's one common ground that I do think that they'll find their way toward is getting some regulation in place.
We'll ask you back in a couple of years to see how that's gone. Ron in Plainfield, New Hampshire. Ron, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks very much. I'm glad to hear you say that people are talking about values and authenticity in our lives, but I'm wondering if people are also talking about the idea that even if the economy rebounds in terms of jobs, that if we base our economy on environmental degradation and continued economic, endless economic growth at the expense of the environment, that that's unsustainable. Are people speaking about much about environmental issues?
You know, what we don't know yet, and this, I think, is the unknown, but I'm beginning to see some signs of what's going on. This is going to be a generational problem to solve. This didn't happen overnight, and it won't get solved overnight. This is going to be a long-term process. And the young people who entered college 4 years ago, for example, this is 2010. Say you entered college in 2006 before the economic downturn began. Mm-hmm. Very good chances that your parents were in pretty good shape. They had good jobs. You probably went to school with a cell phone and a computer and maybe even a full complement of cable channels in your room. At the end of 4 years, your dad or your mother may have lost the job. They may be trying to hang on to their house. And so there are different sets of circumstances for that generation. And it's imprinted on them as they come out of college about what they're looking for and how they're going to live their lives. Marketing companies are already beginning to see that as they survey 17, 18, 19-year-olds about spending habits, for example. So I do think that there is some hope. And when it comes to the environment, across the board, if you talk to younger people, it's a big issue for them because this is their home, this planet, and this is where they're going to have to live. Mm. And they're paying a lot more attention to that. If you look at the changes in recycling, for example, and how people buy products now by paying attention to what the label says about where the material came from, mm-hmm. and whether it's recyclable and so on.
Out on US 50 in Montrose, Colorado, Tom, you talked with Jeff Downs. He's got a ranch dedicated to sustainable farming there, works long hours, doesn't make a lot of profit, but told you he's on the front lines of a movement to raise free-range meat and eat locally. Here he is.
It's definitely not the path of least resistance. Our government's not behind small family farms like us. I don't understand why the corporations with the huge net profits are the ones that are getting the subsidies. I'm not going to feed the whole world this way, but if a farm like mine pops up every 5 miles down the road, we can change this entire food system.
There's a challenge and a hope. One more call, Mike in Williamsburg, Virginia, back on the east end of this big trip. Mike, you're on the air. Our time's short.
Hi, Tom. A pleasure and an honor. I hate to sound redundant, but everyone is honored to speak to you, and I'm just one of those people. So anyhow, my question.
Oh, geez, we lost Mike. I know he wanted to ask you, Tom Brokaw, about race relations and what you saw on Highway 50 on that front.
It's been a subject that has consumed a lot of my personal and professional attention for more than 45 years now, mm-hmm. and we saw another demonstration of it over the weekend. I found very little hostility about race where I was going. There was a case of Kendall Granger, the black minister in East St. Louis, mm-hmm. who's taking on a big issue, which is we've got to restore the place of the black male in the black family. Mm-hmm. And I think that people will find that heartening. The election of an African-American president had an electrifying effect on the African-American population across the country.
No question about that. I mean, in those 45 years, surely this is one area where we can cite improvement.
Oh, you can find unbelievable improvement. I was in Birmingham recently doing another documentary, and I was interviewing the parents of a young girl who was killed in the Birmingham church bombing. Mm. And Birmingham ended up with a very successful black mayor, and the excitement in Alabama when I was there was that Mike Ingram, the Alabama running back, had just become the first University of Alabama player to win the Heisman Trophy. And I thought, remembering the years that I spent in Alabama in the 60s, my God, how far we've come. And it was a fully integrated city, but race in America is a complicated issue, and it's too often not spoken about in a public and candid way, in the way that it needs to. But we've made an enormous amount of progress, and I hope that we can continue down that road as well.
Tom Brokaw's documentary, American Character, along Highway 50, airs next Monday evening on the USA Network. Tom Brokaw, it's been great to have you back, and great speaking with you this hour. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us this hour. Thanks for your calls and your comments. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.